Hello, everyone, and welcome to JFG Tonight. We are with our recurring co-host, James, and we will be talking about love from the perspective of Greek philosophy, Plato. I think that these philosophers, James, there's no chance that they will understand what love is. They didn't have the theory of evolution. We all know now what love is. It is a mechanism for attachment in species that have monogamous interest, because monogamy is better for them than polygamy. And so they fall in love. As far as love for the children, well, it's to care for our genes as they continue into the next generation. Anything other than this is just wrong.
Well, but you didn't tell me where love comes from. What is the origin of love? So, I mean, we're going to have to go through an entire book just to figure out the origin of love and figure out the question. So we might as well just get going.
Yes. And Tarmo has sent a super chat on entropy. He says, JF, will you review Ted's essay, The System's Neatest Trick, on your show for $100? For $100, I'll do any show you want. And so I already told you, Tarmo, that it's an interesting book, and one day I would love to read it. But if you pay me $100, that day will be tomorrow. So, James, The Symposium is an extensive writing by Plato. It is said here to be in its most perfect in form among all of the writings of Plato. So what's interesting about this text? Are we talking about another one of these conversations between people? Is that fiction? Is that science? What is it?
Well, what it is literally is it's a group of people. It's a bunch of famous poets, playwrights, famous men from ancient Athens, Socrates, Alcibiades. There's a bunch of famous people that people might know, like Pausanias and Erechimachus and Aristophanes, who was one of the most famous poets. But these people, they got together at a dinner party, and they were just talking, and they were thinking about drinking and just drinking a lot of alcohol and not talking about anything important. And then one of them says that we should talk about love and bring up the discussion, and they get into it and they discuss the nature of love, and they discuss it in the nature of a eulogy. So we generally think of eulogies as things you give at funerals, but eulogies can also be in praise of something. So they would praise love, for example, and talk about its attributes, its qualities, and that is the style of the book.
So basically the contrary of what a comedian would do these days, which is mock love or be annoyed by love, they were actually trying to do to make a positive eulogy of it.
Yes, they were trying to give a positive, but each was trying to best the next person. So it was a little bit like a debate where one person gives an argument and then the next person adds on to it. But in a symposium is generally a friendly term people use for a debate. So that is the style of the book.
All right. So where does that begin?
Well, I'll just say how we know about it. It's a third-hand account from Plato. So it starts with Apollodorus just walking and talking, and he's saying how he recounts this event, and he was telling it to another person, and then this person told it to Plato. And so this is how Plato got it. And so they start the dinner party, and they're figuring out who should speak first. And Phaedrus goes first. And Phaedrus is a poet, and he begins by affirming that love is Phaedrus begins by affirming that love is a mighty god and wonderful among all gods and men, but especially wonderful in its birth. For he is the eldest of the gods, and in honor of him and a proof of his claim of this honor, that his parents there in no memorial, neither poet nor prose writer, have ever affirmed that he had any higher god. Thus, numerous other witnesses acknowledge that love to be the eldest of the gods. So here, Phaedrus states that both gods and humans regard love, but love is considered the older and the oldest of the gods and has no parents. So here he establishes love in a very mythological religious setting.
This makes me wonder, what do they mean when they say God? They don't mean God like we would think of it. They think of God like any natural force, basically?
Not exactly. They have gods for love, the concept of love. They have gods for, yes, natural forces, but it's kind of like what happened in the Fustel de Collange video, where there was a god in everything in the family, and then eventually they went down to cities, and we're in a much later time now to where they have very established gods for many forces and concepts in life. And so these concepts and forces were called gods, and they were local to certain areas, certain city-states around Greece. But so they varied a little bit, but generally among the Greek culture, they had a lot of similarities.
All right.
Okay. And so, and not only is he the eldest, but he is the source of the greatest benefit to us. For I know not any other greater blessing to a young man who is beginning his life than a virtuous lover, or to the lover a beloved youth. For the principle which ought to guide of men would not be to live nobly. That principle, I say, neither family, nor honor, nor wealth, nor any other motive is to implant, able to implant so well as love. Of what am I speaking? Of the sense of honor and dishonor, without which neither states nor individuals do any good or great work. And I say that a lover who is detected in doing any dishonorable act or submitting through cowardice when dishonor is done to him will be more pained at being detected by his beloved than at being seen by his father or his companions or by anyone else. The beloved, too, when he is found in any disgraceful situation, has the same feeling about his lover. So we'll stop there for a second.
Interesting.
Well, so there's two things I wanted to say. There's this distinction where he's talking about is a lover and a beloved. And so the lover is the person that loves, and the beloved is a person that receives the love. And so generally we consider this in the gender roles as the man is the lover and the woman receives the love. But I don't. This is the one area in the gender roles where I don't necessarily agree. I think that women can be the lover and men the beloved as well, because it's whoever falls in love with that one first. And so that's the one area where, from traditional stereotypes about this, I don't really see a correlation in this that one needs to be male or female. But what they're talking also about homosexual relations here too as well.
Okay. Well, personally, I've seen women fall in love, like in a crazy love, the same way men do. I think it may be more frequent on the side of males, this crazy attachment and the female being the subject, an object of desire. But it definitely can happen on the side of females. But what I found interesting in what he was saying is I think he's saying that once you are in love, the person with whom you are in love or who loves you, you will feel guilt. Even if you're a dishonorable man elsewhere in your life, you will feel more guilt in the face of your lover than you would with the lack of scruple that you have in the rest of your life.
Yeah, like if your lover is embarrassing, does something really brings shame upon you, that he says here, this is the worst thing that you could possibly bear, because to be embarrassed of one's lover is one of the worst pains. And so to be the inverse, proud of one's lover is a great joy. And so that's why Well, I'll just continue with that. And
I should say, I do take issue with the word love. Of course, I know that in the context where it's used, it probably means all forms of relationship, including marriage. But in the modern times, love has been stained as kind of just the emotion of love, and people have gone to pursue just the love and to feel that they could stop the couple when they didn't feel those butterflies anymore. I think it's one of the subversion of modern culture to have put in front the concept of love rather than a concept of responsibility in the couple.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's what was going on. I mean, we were talking about how the religion before this was a marriage, and having children was the highest thing that you could do. And that was pretty much mandatory. You were pretty much banished from the society if you didn't have a marriage and children. But now in this book, you'll see they've really gone into a different state to where they're talking about love as the highest value in a lot of ways. And well, I won't give away everything,
but wouldn't it be the case then that the subversion started in Greece, that it was already there? I'm hearing these poets make the eulogy of love. It's kind of worrying.
Well, I mean,
that it would have gone that far in the past.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we've been influenced by many cultures, and we're just very lucky to have a lot of the writings from Greece. So that's why we can study them. But I'm sure a lot of other cultures had very strong effects on their people as well that we aren't able to study. But mm-hmm. Luckily, we are able to study this, so we will be able to answer that interesting question you raised more accurately. And in the beloved too, when he's found in any disgraceful situation, has the same feeling about his lover. And if they were only some way of contriving that a state or an army should be made up of lovers and their beloved, they should be the very best governors of their own city, abstaining from all dishonor, emulating one's honor, and fighting for each other's side. Although they were a mere handful, they would overcome the world. For what lover would not choose rather than to be seen by mankind than by his beloved? And it just continues on that theme. So, yeah, and I will address the homosexual thing with Greece. I looked up all these men here because all of these men talk about homosexuality, and they all had a family and children. So it wasn't like this was their lifestyle. So in some ways, I'm not saying that evolutionarily homosexuality can ever be good for you. Of course not. But I think that when you identify as one like homosexual or any type of thing, identifying as something is really bad for your genes in modern day. But it was a bit different back then because they had such a strong family that they never even had the idea to identify as homosexual or not. So I think that it probably did still hurt their genes, but far less than.
They were literally butt-fucking no homo.
Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to address it because there's going to be a lot of homosexuality in this book, and
it's sad.
It is what it is, yeah. It is what it is.
I mean, why even the case that you make is not convincing. Even the case that you're reading about is not convincing. Do we know this, that that people who are in love make war more efficiently? I don't know that we know this.
Well, there was a famous sacred band, it was called, in Thebes. And they were made up of lovers and their loves. This is what he was referencing here. And
so they were gay or they were not gay?
They were a band of lovers with their loves. So a gay. But calling them gay is not exactly true because all of them had wives and children too as well. So yes, they had that, but they had wives and children as well. So he makes the case that it's beneficial to you, but... I could see how it might be beneficial in war under a certain cultural narrative where there isn't like when homosexuality isn't very effeminate and like how it is today when, but
well, this is Brokeback Mountain all over again. It's okay if you have a cowboy hat. I'm not convinced at all. There's no fact that indicate that you are a better anything, better worker, better army. And by the way, if that was a fact, we would have societies that have overcome others in battle through being more gay. And you would have societies that are super gay that would have won against everyone else.
Yes, yeah. And I mean, the Greeks were a very powerful army, and many of them did practice this. So there is some evidence that it might have helped them. But the main point is that evolutionarily, it's really not a benefit to you. And when people focus on it today, it's a sidetrack, and it completely takes them out of their genes or reproduction.
Well, I disagree. I mean, it's okay. We can go on and keep analyzing the text, but I just want to state I disagree with your framing of this all as, oh, well, today homosexuality is bad, but because it's monogamy and you don't have children, but back then it was okay. You haven't made a positive argument for this. You are just asking us to either accept it as an article of faith or accept that it was the belief of Plato. Well, I'm not sure exactly what case you're trying to make of these two, but there is no positive case that has been made. Because you don't know how much STDs he had. You don't know if these armies were more efficient as they claim they were. We are in a philosophical poetic text that has no data acquisition of any kind.
Yeah, I'm just reading their arguments here. This is not my arguments. Okay. I'm saying that it's possible that these armies could have been more powerful. I'm open to the possibility. I didn't say that they were. I said it's possible.
Okay.
Also, what I said, though, that I think that might be the argument of distinction is that when the family is really strong, these homosexual practices weren't as deleterious to them because they had such a focus on reproduction. I mean, all of these men had a family. That's something crazy for a bunch of gay men to all have families today. So, I mean, that's something that's
I'm not impressed by it at all. This was the state of homosexuality 60 years ago.
No, it wasn't because
It was. They had they married a woman, and then they were having these adventures on the side or going to bars specifically for this.
Okay, well, I'm not endorsing this either, but yeah, okay.
I'm just being careful because, okay, we are doing analysis of a historical text, but we're also talking to people in 2024, and I just wanted to be clear my view of this to not let the philosophical text insert propaganda in my show.
Yes, well, I would never want to do that to you. And
all right.
Love will make men dare to die for their beloved. Love alone, as a woman as well as men. Of this, Alcestis, the daughter of Periclus, in the monument of Hellas, for she was willing to lay down her life on the behalf of her husband, when no one else would. The reward of the true love of Achilles towards his lover Patroclus, his lover and not his love. The notion that Patroclus was the beloved one is a foolish error into which Aeschylus has fallen. For Achilles was surely the fairer of the two, fairer also than all the other heroes. And greatly as the gods honor the virtue of love, still they return of love in the part of the beloved into the lover who is more admired and valued. For this reason, for affirming that love is the eldest and noblest and mightiest of the gods and the chiefest author and giver of virtue in life and of happiness after death. So the lover pursues their love and the beloved is pursued. So there's that. And one last thing on homosexuality. The one thing that really annoyed me, it was when, what was it, his name? The guy that made the video that said that everyone on the right wing was pushing that the Greeks weren't gay. I've had to read this stuff for the last month, and it's so gay. And all I keep hearing from everyone on the right wing, no, the Greeks weren't gay. And like, it's the most empirical observation I've ever seen in my life. So, yes, they're gay.
I mean, we're only 20 minutes in the show, and this is the gayest 20 minutes I've had this year.
Yeah, so I just wanted to say that. Okay, so the next person, it's been annoying me. Yeah.
Now, do they say it explicitly, or is it in those twist of words because you're talking about love, dying for the loved ones, and you kind of feel that homosexuality is suggested, but do they have a word for gay then?
Well, I don't, from all the things I've written about, it's just talking about his lover and his loved, and then they'll eventually, at the end of this, talk about how someone lies down to Socrates and falls asleep with him and tries to get him to stay the night with him. And so under those words, that sounds gay to me. If you try to sleep with another man and fall asleep with him next to him at night and like get mad when he leaves, when you don't want him to leave. So
they don't say,
to me, this sounds gay.
They don't say homosexuality, or they don't say sex between men. It's just suggested?
No, they don't never really. Well, you can have sex with a man because having sex is for procreation and sex is with a female. So I wouldn't even. And I don't think I see. They don't say sex and they don't say that because I think what they mean is with a woman. And they don't say gay because I don't know the etymology of this, but or they don't say homosexual. Because I think these words are older than this, but I didn't look all this stuff up, so, and I don't really care.
All right. Much. Let's keep going.
Posse anus, the next argument. And he tries to one-up Phaedrus. And so Phaedrus is talking about love as a single character in a way. And so Posse anus tries to one-up him by saying, the argument has not been set before us, I think quite in the right form. We should not be called upon to praise love in such an indiscriminate manner. If there were only one love, then what would you say, what would you said be well enough? But since there are more than one love, should have been by determining which of them was to be the theme of the praise. And I will amend this defect. First of all, I will tell you which love is deserving of praise. Then try to hymn the praiseworthy one in a manner of worthy of him. For we all know that love is inseparable form, Aphrodite, and if there were only one Aphrodite, then there would only be one love. But as there are two goddesses, there must be two loves. And so now he talks about the two goddesses and the two loves. Aphrodite Urania, the daughter of Uranus, represents heavenly, otherworldly form of love, and Aphrodite Pandemia, daughter of Zeus, to represent the common form of love. So these are the two loves he's talking about.
Heavenly and common.
Yeah, yeah. And
what is heavenly love?
Well, it's not really well defined yet. And it will get better defined as it goes on, but he leaves it pretty loose here, and he leaves it kind of mystical and religious at this point. I mean, I could jump ahead, but that will be later gone into.
All right.
And evil is the vulgar lover who loves the body rather than the soul, inasmuch as he is not stable because he loves a thing which is in itself unstable, and therefore, when in the bloom of youth, when Desiring is over. He takes wing and flies away. In spite of all his words and promises, where the love of the noble disposition is lifelong, for it becomes one with the everlasting. The custom of our country would have both of them proven well and truly, and would have us yield to one sort of lover and avoid another. Therefore, encourages some to pursue and others to fly, testing both the lovers and beloved in contest of trials until they show which of the two classes they respectively belong. And this is the reason why, in the first place, as hasty attachment is held to be dishonorable, because time is the true test of this, and as of most other things. Secondly, there is dishonor in being overcome by the love of money, wealth, or political power. When a man is frightened into surrender by the loss of them, or having experienced the benefits of money or in political corruption, is unable to rise from the seductions of them, for none of these things are of permanent or lasting nature, not to mention that of no generous friendship ever sprung from them. There remains then only one way of honoring attachment, which custom allows in the beloved, and this is the way of virtue. For as we admit that any service which the lover does to him is not to be accounted flattery or dishonor to him, so that the beloved has one way or only of voluntary service which is not dishonorable, this is virtuous service.
I'm desperate about what you're laying out here, because I realize that cultural subversion didn't start in the 60s against Western civilization. It started in those very writings, when he writes about bodily love being evil and this whole detachment of, oh, there's this good type of love and then there's this bad type of love. And there is already here a kind of denial of humans as part of nature and an elevation of humans above the animals, which is an element of subversion in my view.
Oh, you said that beautifully, JF. You took the words out of my mouth. This is the Aphrodite Urania, the otherworldly form of love. And so he brings it into concepts more into like the realm of idealism, as we were talking about in shows before. Mm-hmm. And so this is where he brings love into. And you can obviously see Plato is the writer of this, because this almost is starting to become like a Platonic form in a way. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have too much for this guy, so we can move on. But I just wanted to say he talks a lot about virtue, and virtue is defined in two different ways. So there's a little bit of subversion here by Plato, because Plato defines virtue as wisdom, courage, moderation, and justice. And in ancient Greece, virtue had a little bit of a different meaning. It was goodness or excellence, but it meant it came from the word aristocracy, because it came from arete. And aristocracy is the rule of the best people. So it's a little bit different, but the best people is a very subjective meaning. So virtue, to be defined this strictly by Plato, really encompasses it in the definition he wants to frame the argument. And so I think that is something that needs to be mentioned here, at least.
Okay. Well, I note an intellectualization of everything, including love here.
Yeah. I mean, that's what this is. It's called an encomium, or like a dialogue, and they just talk about the nature of love and pretty much give every attribute to it that you can possibly give it. Okay. And there will be a critique of this later, but we'll see. Okay. Oreximachus. Seeing that Pausanias made a fair beginning, but a lame ending, I must endeavor to supply his deficiency. I think that he had rightly distinguished two kinds of love. But my art further informs me that the double love is not merely an affection of the soul of man towards the fair or towards anything, but is to be found in the bodies of all animals and in the production of the earth. And I may say in all of this, such is the conclusion which I seem to have gathered from my own art of medicine, whence I learn how great and wonderful and universal is the deity of love, whose empire extends over all things, divine as well as human. Well, I'll just say, I should have said this before, Eryximachus is a doctor, and he is going off the humors theory of medicine, where that means you have to balance the humors. So there's like blood, bile, snot, all the different fluids in the body need to be balanced out. And once they're balanced, this creates good health. And so this is the theory he's going on, and he's making a metaphor of it to describe love.
I think he's also seeing love in absolutely natural phenomena. He's saying, look around you and look at the complexity and the beauty of the organization of bodies, animals, even perhaps volcanoes and the planet itself. And he's saying you can feel love going throughout all of existence, even without humans to feel it.
I didn't get that out of it, but no? Well, we'll see as I keep reading.
All right. But that's what I got from the beginning.
From medicine, I will begin that I may do honor to my art. There are human bodies. These are two kinds. There are in the human body these two kinds of love, which confessedly different and unalike. And being unalike, they have loves and desires which are unalike. And the desire of the healthy one and the desire of the diseased one is another. It has Pausanias, just as now, is to indulge good men is honorable and bad men dishonorable. So too in the body, the good and the healthy elements are to be indulged, and the bad elements of the diseases are not to be indulged, but discouraged.
This sounds like a yin-yang equilibrium type of stuff.
Exactly. Doesn't this remind you of Chinese philosophy? Yeah. That's what this sounds like. I've heard, because I listened to a lot of reviews of this, and a couple guys said this, that it reminds of Chinese philosophy. So you made the same correlation.
All right.
I just want to check my notes there. Okay. The best physician is he who is able to separate fair love from foul, to convert one into the other, and he who knows how to eradicate and how to implant love. Whatever is required and how can reconcile the most hostile elements in the constitution, make them loving friends, is a skilled practitioner. And now the most hostile are the most opposite, such as hot and cold, bitter and sweet, moist and dry. So here he balances out the opposites in the body to promote health. And Urania, so he builds off of the other speech. So Aphrodite, Urania, he applies to that. He gives nutrition. He says Aphrodite, Urania gives nutrition to the body, and Aphrodite, Pandemia leads to sickness. But like in medicine, they need to be balanced out. So we can't have too much nutrition or too much sickness. They have to be like in balance, which is not really true. But that was his theory.
What a bunch of bullshit. Let's keep going.
The doctor's role then is to implant one type of love in the body and flush out the wrong kind in order to reconcile and create love between the antagonistic elements of the body, such as hot and cold, dry and sweet. And I think that's all I wanted to mention on him.
So these guys, Eryximachus, they just have their pet peeves, and they come to the freaking Coliseum to mix up their pet peeve with the current theme, which is love, and what they bring has nothing to do with love.
Oh, let me just say, this is probably not a historical event. This is probably just a novel by Plato, and he just created these characters that were real people, and he's just giving them words to make them sound a little less than perfect so that Socrates can come in at the end and destroy them all and seem like the best philosopher ever. So, that's also a theory of why their arguments seem a little less than perfect. Okay. So there's that as well. I probably should have said that earlier. Eryximachus concludes that love is ever present and all powerful in our lives, as it is the cause of all self-control, happiness, justice, and it produces good action. Okay, so as I was saying, each kind of build on each other, and then, we'll go to the next one. But do you have anything else to say?
No, I'm good. Let's see where this goes.
Okay, let me just, I just want to mention and make sure we remember, because it's important to remember the key concepts of him. So the two key concepts of him: love is not higher or lower, but there are two loves and they must be balanced correctly. Well, it is higher or lower, but they must be balanced. So they have their own goods and qualities. And then bringing love into concept is not just, this brings love into concepts and is not just from gods or humans, because he's not talking about as love just as a god. He's now talking about it as a metaphor, as a concept in a way. So he brings it into that. Okay, the next one. Aristophanes. Okay, so one historical thing about Aristophanes is our knowledge of Socrates is really only through Plato, except for Aristophanes. He's a famous poet that wrote The Clouds, and it was he's a comic poet generally, so he wrote comedies, and he wrote a comedy satirizing, being satirical of Socrates, and so that's one thing about him. So he is a very famous man.
Oh, all right. Yeah.
Aristophanes professed to open another vein of discourse. He had a mind to praise love in another way. Mankind, he said, judging by their neglect of him, having never, as I think, at all understood the power of love. In the first place, let me treat of the nature of man and what has happened to it. For the original human nature was not like the present, but different. The sexes were not two, as they are now, but three in number. There was man, woman, and the union of two. Having a name corresponding to this double nature, which had once a real existence, but now lost, in the word androgynous, is only preserved as a term of reproach. In the second place, the primeval man was round, and his back and sides formed a circle, and he had four hands and four feet and one head and two faces, looking opposite ways, set on a round neck and precisely alike. Also, four ears, two private parts, and remainder to correspond. Males were descended from the sun and the females from the earth, and those androgynous were descendants of the moon. And they were very powerful and vigorous and made threatening attacks on the gods. And the gods did not want to destroy them because they would then forfeit the sacrifices humans made to them. So Zeus decided to cut each person in two. He decided that if this didn't settle humans down, he would cut them in two once again, and they would have to hop on one leg. Each person was cut in two. Apollo then turned their heads around so that they would be facing each other's gash that had been made, so as to remind them constantly of the punishment they had been dealt. He also pulled their skin tight to cover up their gash, tying them around the navel. So this is a comic telling of a story that has metaphorical power. And I can just talk about the metaphorical power, but do you have any comments?
Well, I'm surprised that the trans community and the LGBT aren't quoting Plato as approving of them and having predicted their existence, because I'm reminded of them.
Yes, yes, it is a little bit reminding. But this is actually one of the most quoted parts of this book at weddings, actually, because... Okay. I'll get into it. And so people will probably recognize the part because it's a very, very famous passage. After the division of the two parts of man, each desiring his other half, came together and throwing their arms around each other, entwined in mutual embraces, longing to grow into one. They were on the point of dying from hunger and self-neglect, but they did not like to do anything apart. When one of the halves died, the other survived. The survivor sought another mate, man or woman, as we call them, being the sections of the entire man or entire woman that clung to that. They were destroyed when Zeus, in pity of them, invented a new plan. He turned the parts of the generation round to the front so that they had not always been in their position. And they sowed the seed no longer in the ground, but in each other. And after that transposition, the male generated in the female, in order that by the mutual embrace of man and woman, they might breed and the race might continue. So the two, we were all, according to this, originally androgynous, the male and female into us, had all the extra limbs, and Zeus cut us in half, and we lost our original self. And so
we were combined together.
And then we were chopped in two. And so his very poetic way of saying that's often quoted at wedding is we're trying to find our original true self. And so that's why people talk about I'm finding my soulmate or the person that was meant for me, because it was originally your other half. And so that's one of the most romantic parts that people often quote in this.
Okay, interesting. But false. Yeah.
I think so. I mean, we might need to do more research.
This is not how sex has emerged at all.
I don't think so, yeah. I think so. I think the biologists would know. And when... let me just grab a drink of water. I don't think I need to read any more from him. I think you guys get the idea. Let me just check my key themes. He takes back... one thing to remember is it's called like this law of attraction. You find the other person you are previously separated from, and it returns you into original harmony. So this will be critiqued later, but it's often called like a law of attraction. You're attracted to your original self. Okay, we can go on to Agathon. Agathon, the previous speaker, instead of praising the god love or unfolding his nature, appears to have congratulated mankind on the benefits which he confers upon them. But I would rather praise the god first and then speak of his gifts. This is always the right way of praising everything. May I say without impiety or offense that of all the blessed gods, he is the most blessed because he is the fairest and the best. And he is the fairest for, in the first place, he is the youngest. And in his youth, he is himself the witness, fleeing out of the way of age, who is swift enough, swifter truly than most of us. Like love hates him and will not come near him, but youth and love live and move together. So here he makes the argument that the god love is the youngest of the god, because love generally happens in youth. And so that is his argument here so far.
Okay.
Furthermore, Agathon suggests love is sensitive rather than being settled in hard parts of humans and gods, or on the ground or in the skull. Love settles in the mind and in characters. Further, love will only settle in the mind and characters of those with soft natures, and move on when he finds someone with a tough character that can pass unnoticed and in and out of our minds. Suggest further that the god is fluid. Agathon goes on to speak about the virtues of love. Love is just because he is never forced and never uses force. Everything consists to his authority. Love practices moderation. Since he can master pleasure and desires, love is braver than Ares, the god of war, since Ares fell in love with Aphrodite and was thus mastered by love. Love is wiser, since he is the inspiration for all other acts of wisdom. No poet can be wise without love, nor could the gods or muses master their respective arts without love for those arts. These gods only become organized when love came into being and were motivated by a love of beauty. Before that time, they were governed by necessity and did all sorts of horrible things. I say of love. Okay.
So I can see the use and the function of attributing all those concepts to gods, where it personifies the concept, and perhaps it helps the human brain realize certain things that they wouldn't if they were just focusing on the fact. I guess that's what I see in what you just said. It's a method to personify love and call love he. I believe that's what happened here. He, the god of love. Maybe it helps figure out what the ins and outs of love.
Yeah. It's a useful tool sometimes to discover qualities for something. So it's not completely without use. I say of love that he is the fairest and the best in himself, and the cause of which is fairest and best in all other things. And there comes to mind the line of poetry in which he is said that to be the God who gives peace on earth and calms the stormy sea, who stills the winds and bids the sufferer sleep. This is he who empties men of dissatisfaction and fills them with affection, who makes them to meet each other at banquets such as these, and sacrifices, feasts, and dances. He is our Lord, who sends courtesy and sends away discourtesy, who gives kindness ever and never gives unkindness, the friend of the good, the wonder of the wise, the amazement of the gods, desire by those who have no part in him, and precious to those who have the better part in him. Parent of the delicacy, luxury, desire, fondness, softness, grace, regard of the good, regardless of evil in every word, work, wish, and fear, savior, pilot, comrade, helper, glory of gods, and leader, men, leader, best, brightest, in whose footstep let every man follow, sweetly singing in his honor, joining in that sweet strain which the love charms the souls of God and men. So this guy is a poet. He wanted to go on and praise love. So what he does is he establishes that what the first person said, that love is the eldest of gods. He keeps going with that, the lover and beloved distinction, and he affirms that there's Aphrodite Urania and the common form of love, Pandemia, and that there's higher loves, and that you're going to find your original self. And he praises this all, brings it all together, and everyone praises him. And they think they've just ended. And then Socrates comes up and has a problem with what he said. And so that's the point we are at in the dialogue.
Interesting. Pandemia, interesting name for love. I think they're making up a chicken and the egg problem with whether love is a thing of youth or a thing of the elder. In the end, if love is necessary for reproduction, it has to be cyclic. Doubting Thomas comes with a question. He says, question for James. What are your thoughts on the Christian combination of both God is love, John, and God is the Word, Logos? Can any synthesis like this make sense?
It doesn't make sense literally, but I'll explain what he means by this. Is that when he says God is love, he's thinking of God in a way as a God in this Greek sense that applies conceptual values to him. And so Jesus says, I am love. And he also talks about love in other ways, because he does kind of the same thing that he's doing here, is he ascribes all the qualities and virtues of love to himself, and also can also make descriptions of it, just like in this book. And you can actually see in parts of the New Testament that there are some similarities between this book and parts of the New Testament, because one of the main writers of the New Testament was Paul, and he was a well-studied Greek Jewish man that knew Greek and studied a lot of Greek traditions. So it is very possible he read this work.
All right.
Okay, so we'll go on to Socrates now. Socrates ironically admits that he would be incapable of following up Agathon's speech. He conceives that he must make a similar eulogy. However, he asks Phaedrus if he might be permitted to give a different kind of eulogy, one that speaks of truth. Phaedrus consents to this request and consents also to Socrates' further request that he might ask Agathon some questions as to make his speech.
All right. So again, they're all coming with their pet peeves, and none of them are talking about love.
Yeah. Don't worry. I will never talk about Plato again on this show. But what I wanted to do was I wanted to punish you all because you all have been talking about how amazing Plato is. And all I see from the right wing everywhere is he is the best philosopher ever. So I'm giving you Plato.
This because I would have never read this on my own, but it's good to have it imposed on me to realize just how bad these thinkers were and how useless they were. And it's super dangerous culturally what you're presenting. Those were confused people thinking about, confused about gods, multiple gods. Gods are not necessarily gods, and they are also concepts, and seeing love everywhere. You can see the stemming confusion of a hippie in these people.
Yeah. It's the way that they constantly change God from its very mystical state in the beginning to a more logical, but they're melding the two together in such a disharmonious, lying way that it's very off-putting to a scientific person like us, I think. Mm-hmm. So I imagine that the topic of praise should be true, Socrates says, and that this is to be presupposed. And out of the true, the speaker was to choose the best and set forth the best manner. I felt quite proud thinking that the nature, so he's just saying that he thinks that we should talk about the truth and he should be allowed to do this. And they all agree. Agathon, may I ask you, whether love is the love of something or of nothing? And here I must explain myself. I do not want to say that love is the love of a father or the love of a mother. That would be ridiculous. But to answer as you would, if you would ask, is a father of something? To which he would find no difficulty in replying, of a son or a daughter. And the answer would be right. Very true, said Agathon. And you would say the same of a mother. You know what? We don't have a whole lot of time left. This goes on for a while. Let me just read the end of it because he kind of restates his argument and it gives a decent summary of it. But if you guys want to read it,
I kind of like the trend that you were on there because he's talking about seeing language as object-oriented in a way. And I guess maybe it's my bias because I'm currently in programming. I do a lot of coding, computer coding. And in object programming, there's this idea that the object is always an instance of some class. And he's saying you cannot just be a father. You have to be a father of a child. And you have to be in love with someone.
Why don't I read the argument then? It'll take a little while.
Let's go through this current point and finish what you wanted to finish. And perhaps we can split this show in two and you could come back in a week and we can continue later.
Okay, so this show was originally androgynous and now we're splitting it in two into the male and the female, right? Just like
Aristotle said.
Yes. Okay. That's a terrible joke. Okay.
Plato geek jokes.
Yeah.
Two people laughed across the internet.
Okay. Where was I? He assented. Let me ask you one more question to illustrate my meaning. Is not a brother to be a brother to be regarded essentially as a brother of something? Certainly, he replied. That is, of a brother or a sister. Then he said, now, said Socrates, I will ask about love. Is love of something or of nothing? Of something, surely, he replied. Keep in mind what this is and tell me what I want to know. Whether love desires that of which love is? Surely he. Yes, surely. And he does not possess. He does not possess that which he loves and desires. Probably not, I should say. Nay, said Socrates, I would have you consider whether necessarily it is not rather the word, the inference, that he who desires something in a want of something, and that he who desires nothing in the want of nothing. In my judgment, Agathon, absolutely and necessarily true. What do you think? I agree with you, said Agathon. Very good. he who is great desires to be great, or he is strong desires to be strong. That would be inconsistent with our previous admissions. For he who is anything cannot want to be that which he is not. Very true. And yet, added Socrates, if a man, being strong, desire to be strong, or swift, desire to be swift, or healthy, desire to be healthy, in that case, might, though he desire something that he already has, given that the example, blah, blah, blah. Okay, you can't desire something that you already have. That's that whole part. And do you have any comments, Jeff?
Interesting point.
Okay. He must, replied Agathon. And then Socrates said, he desires that which he at present may be preserved to him in the future, which is the equivalent to saying he desires something which is not existent to him and which he has that he has not got. And keeps going with...
It's interesting, but it's dangerous because a lot of people interpret this as meaning love is only possible in outside of marriage, basically. Love is only possible with this object of desire that is unattainable. And it leads to all this infidelity and polygamous behavior and the whole concept that once you're together, that's not love anymore. The butterflies aren't there. So it's time to divorce.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think love can be one of the most dangerous things for people that want to reproduce in a way. But it also can be very wonderful. But if people get too focused on the ideal form of it, it can lead you into many unfortunate lifestyles. So he goes on. Very true, he said. Then he and everyone who desires that he has not already, and which in the future and not in the present, which he has not and is not, for which he is in want, there are the sort of things which love and desire seek. Very true, he said. Then now, said Socrates, let us recapitulate the argument. First, is not love of something and of something too, which is wanting to a man? Yes, he replied. Further replied, what you said in your speech, or if you do not remember, I will remind you. And, I think I said this, but he's talking to Agathon right now, the guy who just gave the previous speech. Remember further what you said in your speech, or if you do not remember, I will remind you. You said that love of the beautiful set in order the empire of the gods, for that of deformed things there is no love. But did you not say that of that kind? Yes, said Agathon. Yes, my friend, I will remark was a just one, if this is true. Love is love of the beauty and not of the deformity. He assented. And this admission he already made, that love is of something which a man has and has not. True, he said. Then love wants and has not beauty. Certainly, he said. Would you not call the beautiful which wants and does not have beauty? Would you call the beautiful which wants and does not possess beauty? Certainly not. Then would you still say that love is beautiful? Agathon replied, I fear that I did not understand what I was saying. You made a very good speech, Agathon, replied Socrates, but there is yet one small question which I would fain ask. Is not the good also the beautiful? Yes, that in wanting the beautiful, love wants also the good. I cannot refute you, Socrates, said Agathon. Let us assume that what you say is true. So there's that little dialogue there.
Are these the people we call sophists?
No. Socrates is apparently the opposite of a sophist.
The opposite.
So that's why I kind of like the sophist, because he sounds like a sophist.
Because that's what I would call sophistry, what was just said here. But it's interesting from, not even from the point of perspective of love, but the whole game that he just played here, trying to squeeze an argument that, well, if love likes beauty, and love is a desire, you cannot desire what you don't have. Therefore, love would be deprived of beauty. Love would be ugly.
Yeah. And what he does is he just turns his argument against himself. And so he uses this as this is what dialectics is. This is using the false reasoning and constantly making the argument appear the better. And so he's talking about that. I'm trying to find, I have a very good description of dialectics, but I have so many notes that I'm getting lost now. But anyways, that's little speech there. And we have about one third left. Should we finish, JF?
Yeah, I mean, keep going. I'm up for the punishment. I feel sadomasochist tonight. Let's go through the grueling punishment.
Okay. I'm sorry, JF, but I just thought that...
I like it. You know, this is being an intellectual is very often to impose stuff on yourself that others wouldn't. And that's what ultimately leads you to learn more things. And I learn a lot from what you're saying. I learn about how fucked up these people were and how we shouldn't have recorded them in history at all. We would have been better using these tablets to wipe our asses.
Yeah. Okay, so the next part of it, Socrates talks with, he recounts an event that happened with Diotima, and she's a priestess. And the arguments that she's giving are pretty much the arguments of Socrates. So what's really happening here is Socrates is giving his arguments through the mouth of a priestess, because if you give your arguments through religion, people are more likely to agree with them. And these people are obviously have made a lot of strong words, how they want to be the most religious and pious of the gods. So that's what Socrates is doing here. So when Diotima speaks, think of Socrates speaking, and then he's like one of his students, and Socrates is like one of his students. So I'll go on from there. Socrates continues.
Now, just to clarify, did you say that you have only one third of the content left, or we are through one third of the content?
We're through one tenth of it.
One tenth of
just kidding. we're through two thirds of it, so we have one third left.
So basically, we can get through the whole book within the next 30 minutes and complete the show for today.
Yes.
Okay, let's do this.
Okay. Socrates continued his discussion of love by restating an account given to... I changed to a different... because I didn't like how I did that first one. Okay, so here it is. First, I say to her, in nearly the same words which he used to me, that love was a mighty god, and likewise fair, and she proved to me, as I proved to him, that by my own showing, love was neither fair nor good. What do you mean, Diotima? I said, is love then evil and foul? Hush, she cried, must that be foul which is not fair? Certainly, I said, and that which is not wise, ignorant? Do you not see that there be a mean between wisdom and ignorance, and that may be? I said, right opinion? She replied, which, as you know, being incapable of giving a reason, in which not know a reason in not knowledge, for how can knowledge be devoid of reason, nor again ignorance, for neither can ignorance attain the truth, but either clearly something which in a mean between ignorance and wisdom, quite true, I replied. Do not insist, she said. I'll just give a little key into what she's talking about here. I have a lot of agreement, actually, with a lot of this speech in the way it goes, but there's a very interesting subversion of how it changes at the end. And so, I mean, you guys can all interpret it the way you want to. I don't want to impose my view, but that's at least how I've seen it so far. So, but I'll keep going unless you have something to say, JF.
No, I fail to understand. What is your view of that segment?
No, not that segment so far. I just wanted to give that. Maybe I shouldn't have included that segment because it didn't have a lot of quality to it. But I wanted to start off the discussion. So I get that.
Because
there.
I
so
haven't
maybe I
understood at all what was said there.
Yeah, let me maybe finish the paragraph and then we can talk about it. Do not then insist, she said. Okay, I said that. Well, then I say, love is surely admitted by all to be a great God, by those who know or by those who do not know, by all. And then how Socrates, she said with a smile, can love be acknowledged to be a great God by those who say he is not a God at all? And who are they? I said, you and I are two of them, she replied. How can that be? I said, it is quite intelligible, she replied. For you yourself would acknowledge that the gods are happy and fair, of course, and would say that any God was not, certainly not, I replied, and mean that the happy of those who are possessors of things good and fair. Yes, I admit that love, because I want to desire those good and fair things of which he is in want. Yes, I did. But how can he be a God who is not in no portion in which either good or fair? Impossible. Then you see that you can also deny the divinity of God. Okay,
I'm
so
confused.
Socrates puts in the mouth of the priestess a kind of blasphemous statement, but he puts it in the mouth of the priestess to get by that Eros is not a god. Well, let me just read this part because I think, then what is love? I asked. Is he mortal? No. What then? As in the former instance, he is neither mortal nor immortal, but in a mean between the two. What is he, Diotima? He is a great spirit, a daimon. Like a spirit, he is intermediate between the divine and mortal. What I say then? Is he power? He interprets. What is his power? He interprets, she replied, between gods and men. So what he's saying here, love is not a god here. He is a spirit. So what he's later going to be talking about is a Platonic form in a way, a concept. So love is an absolute form that we must attain, like strive to. And so this is how he reinterprets it here. And he calls love between gods and men.
A demon.
And that's the way he put it. Daemon. It's
demon.
It's different. Yeah, demon.
Well, I mean, clearly he was talking about kind of a floating spirit. We're into absolute witchcraft, James. And you're slowly making me a Christian. Because you know what? I'm reading this shit. And then I'm reading parts of the Bible, and you have to realize then the Bible has been written in Greek, right? So in the same, they had the same letters as these people. They had the same potential words, and yet the Bible makes much more sense. And now I'm just realizing, you know, around Jesus Christ times, the Bible looks like a solid book compared to this.
Yeah, I mean, it was 500 years later, and I would agree with you that the Bible is a lot more readable than these texts, but they hold a lot of deep concepts that what they say is like Christianity is Platonism for the masses, and you can see how some of these ideas diffuse into Christianity. Obviously, not all of them, and not a lot of the sexual ones, because Christianity has very different sexual practices than ancient Greece. But a lot of the core concepts, and they make it in a way that's more readable for the average person. And you can obviously see why Christianity became so popular, because it's a very easy to read book.
Yes.
So,
And I do see a lot of... There's something that was inherited by Christianity of some of this, but much crap was left behind.
That is true, yeah. For you say generally that all desire of good and happiness is the only great and subtle powers of love, but they who are drawn towards him by any other path, whether the path of money-making or gymnastics or philosophy, are not called lovers. The name of the whole is appropriate to those who affection takes one form, or they alone are said to love or to be lovers. I dare say, I replied, that you are right. Yes, she added, and you hear people say that lovers are seeking for their other half. But I say that they are seeking neither for the half of themselves nor for the whole, unless the half or the whole be also good. And they will be cut off. They will cut off their own hands and feet, cast them away if they are evil. For they love what is not their own, unless perchance there be someone who calls what belongs to him the good, and what belongs to another evil.
The controversial question of whether you should remain incel if all you see around you are bad women, evil women.
Yes, that's an interesting question. For there is nothing which men love but the good. Is there anything, certainly I say, that there is nothing? Then she said, the simple truth is that men love the good. Yes, I said, to which must be added that they love the possession of the good. Yes, that must be added. And not only the possession, but the everlasting possession of the good. That must be added too. Then love, she said, may be described generally as the love of the everlasting possession of the good. That is the most true. So why I said I kind of like some of this, because I'm trying to be generous in some way, because I bashed Socrates all last show, so I'm trying to be at least a little generous here. And what I like is the everlasting possession of the good, because I kind of see that in a way of when you want to find your lover and reproduce with her. Well, what are you doing? You're trying to select for the best quality partner you can get, and you're trying to produce offspring into everlasting time, keep going, and you're trying to produce, well, this is what you love, and this is what you should strive for. So if I wanted to be really generous and provide a metaphor, that's kind of how I see some of this. But I don't think this is exactly what she's saying, but it's kind of what I've gotten a little bit out of it in some way.
She's saying there's a claim to possession in love.
Yes. Possession of the good is not only possession, but the everlasting possession of the good. This is generally considered the good, the everlasting possession of the good. I mean, it's tough to critique all this because they're not really arguments.
Let's keep going.
There are lesser mysteries of love into which even you, Socrates, may enter the greater and more hidden ones, which are the crown of these, to which, if you pursue them in the right spirit, they will lead. I know not whether you will be able to attain, but I will do my utmost to inform you and to follow if you can. For he who proceeds in the right manner should begin to visit beautiful forms. And first, he be guided by his instructor aright, to love one, but guided by his instructor aright, to love one such form only out of that which he should create fair thoughts, and soon he will of himself perceive that the beauty of one form is akin to the beauty of another, and that the beauty of form in general is the pursuit of how foolish he will not be able to recognize that the beauty in every form is the same. And he will perceive this, he will abate his violent love of the one which he despise and deem a small thing, and will be a lover of all beautiful forms. In the next stage, he will consider that the beauty of the mind is more honorable than the beauty of the outward form, so like the body. So that is a virtuous soul have but one little comeliness. He may be content to love and tend himself, and will search and bring forth the birth thoughts, which may improve the young, until he compelled to contemplate and see the beauty of institutions, laws, and to understand that the beauty of them, all of them, of one family, and that personal beauty is a trifle, and after laws and institutions, he will go on to the sciences, and that he may see their beauty. Being not like a servant in love with the beauty of one youth or man or institution, instead a slave, mean, narrow-minded, but drawing towards the contemplation of a vast sea of beauty, which will create many fair and noble thoughts on the notions in boundless love and wisdom, until on that shore he grows and waxes strong, and the last vision is revealed of a single science, which is the science of beauty everywhere.
So we're in the Platonic forms here, the elevation to ideas.
Yes. And we have one page and a half left. He who has been instructed thus far in the things of love, who has learned to see that the beautiful in due order and succession, when it comes toward the end, will suddenly perceive a nature of wondrous beauty in this. And Socrates is the final cause of our former toils, a nature which in the first place is everlasting, not growing or decaying, waxing or waning. Secondly, in one fair point view, that one time relation to another. Let me just skip to the end of this because I don't think this part is too important. This, my dear Socrates, said the stranger of Mantinea, is that life above all others which man should live in the contemplation of beauty absolute, a beauty which if you once beheld, you would see not to be after the measure of gold garments, fair boys and youths, whose presence now entrances you. And you may, a one, would be content to live seeing them only in conversing with them without meat or drink. If that were possible, you would only want to look at them and be with them. But if man had eyes to see the true beauty, the divine beauty, I mean, pure, dear, unalloyed, not clogged with the pollutions of morality and the colors and vanities of human life, thinner in looking and holding converse with the true beauty, simple and divine, remember how that communion only, beholding beauty with the eyes of the mind, will be enabled to bring forth, and not images of beauties, but realities, for he has not of an image, but of a reality, and bringing forth nourishing true virtue to become the friend of God and be immortal, if mortal man may be that of an ignoble life. All right.
What does that mean?
Well, he brings back the beauty in. So this is the summary of it all, where it's the lower form. He brings back all of the key hits from previously that we saw. And I may have skipped over of them too in a moment of time, but let me just go over the key hits. So he talked about how love is the eldest of gods, and there's two forms of God, but the higher form of God, the lower form of God is between humans, and the higher form of God is wisdom and philosophy. And so this higher form of love should be our aim in life, according to Plato, in this part, Socrates in this. And our highest form is to seek wisdom and to seek the purest form of wisdom that exists. And so that is the meaning of this right here. And all of the speeches end, and they're about to end. But then, what's his name? Alcibiades walks in, drunken and in a stupor, and he wants to join. And what he does is he says they're praising love. So what he does is he talks about how Socrates is his lover and that he loves Socrates, because he misunderstands in a way where he's not talking about it philosophically. He's talking about it literally, because he's a man of action in a way. He's completely different than all these other people. He's a great statesman of the time that's conducted many wars And so he's a very different type of person than the rest of these people. That's a poet. So he talks about it literally, how he loves Socrates. And he gives many romantic things that I won't bore you with. So that's why I'm just talking about it. And so he talks about how Socrates is his ideal form. And he talks about, he starts his speech by saying, Socrates, you are a satyr, meaning you are ugly. And so it's very weird to call your lover ugly. So why is he your lover? Because what we established that, I mean, he was talking, Socrates is the beloved, and the beloved is always the beautiful. So how can Socrates be the beautiful if he is ugly? Well, we just established before this that pure love is in the forms. And in the forms, the most beautiful is the most wise and most philosophical. Therefore, Alcibiades loves Socrates because he is the most wise and most philosophical. And he gives a physical representation of that by loving Socrates. And so in a way, it's kind of, he kind of mocks a traditional aristocrat, in my view.
So is Plato today here playing a kind of comedic routine, trying to go through all the thinking you've laid out and reaching an hilarious or wrong conclusion?
No, I think he's talking about this literally. It's that he's giving, because actually people were confused about this, and because it's a very strange ending to the book, that someone comes in drunk and starts hitting on Socrates and like trying to get him to sleep with him. It goes on for a little while, and it's a really strange ending of the book. And a lot of thinkers have been debating this for many centuries. And I think the leading theory I go with is that it's, like I said, it's the physical representation of the arguments Plato's making. That instead of using lofty concepts and rhetoric and argumentation to prove his point, he chooses the person with one of the most highest authorities, the most respected, and a very respected general of the time, to profess that he loves Socrates so that his arguments might seem even more like correct in a way.
Yeah, I mean, I would have to read it more in depth, but it does sound like typical parodic writing, where you put a drunk man and the drunk man is more right than all the others that spoke before. It sounds like you would do in modern times in comedy.
Yeah, it's a little bit comedic, and it can be a little bit funny. I have some. Do you want me to read some of it? I have a little bit of parts.
I mean, we'll be headed toward the end, so if you can go through it fast. There's Saturn Shine, who says, men need to stop idolizing the big face, fake breast woman, the overly made up woman, that kind of stuff. That's why women go and get fake breasts and mess up their faces. Yes, I agree that that. Anyways, I don't think that men adore fake breasts and makeup that much. Perhaps there are some brutes out there that are just primarily driven toward this. Personally, I find natural women extremely beautiful. James, do you have a take, a position on the fake breast?
Yeah, I've never liked fake breasts. I'm actually pro diversity in breast. I don't discriminate too much, where I generally prefer smaller, but you know, if you get a cute girl with some big goofy breast, I don't mind that either. So I'm
all right.
I'm cool with it too. All right.
So we're headed toward the conclusion. So whatever it is that you want to conclude with, go ahead.
Okay. So we've been given a lot of talk about love. And so I thought I'd like to give a little bit of a talk about it shortly. And I think that if you want to love, first, let's look at the individual. The individual should have pride in himself. And if you have pride in yourself, you will want the best for yourself. You'll want for the best for yourself into the future, genetically. And what should you seek? Well, you should seek a good lover that will look after your genes as much as you look after your own. And so, in a way, looking after your own genes as much as the other person's, that's how you love, is you care for them because they're becoming a partner for you. You're intermixing yourself. You're, in a way, becoming one, in a way, throughout time, where you're mixing your genes together and you're creating offspring that are permanently together for the rest of humanity as long as they reproduce. So in a way, if you look at it from the genetic perspective, they often say that science is the opposite of poetry and love. But in a way, it's very beautiful to see how you can intermix yourself with someone. And if you can really look at it from a perspective of science, there's no reason not to love the person you're with, you're reproducing with. And there's no reason not to make things work and not to try to find the best in the other person, because you're really becoming one, in a way. And that is, I mean, the highest praise of love I can give.
I fully agree with this. You have been an idealist in love. Have you been pursuing, it seems from past discussions we've had, you and I remember you are pursuing ideal love. Is that correct?
Yeah, I generally have pretty high standards. And that's why I really want a woman that is really wants the best for herself. And like I said, oftentimes you see women that really don't take care of themselves. They're very loose in their thinking. And you can tell that, in a way, they don't really care about themselves that much. They're not really planning their life out. I'm looking for a woman that can really see that in herself, that wants to plan out her life and wants the best for herself and sees that in myself as well. And so we can live that project together. And so I think that's kind of the ideal form of love. But I understand as well that in this life, unfortunately, we go through compromises. But I've been through a phase in my life where I've been trying not to make compromises on the ideal woman so far.
All right. Well, I made compromises all my life in 200 relationships of love where they were really not worthy of being loved. But at 40 years old, I found a woman absolutely deserving of being loved and adored. And so I cannot believe that this youthful emotion that love is, I get to fully experience it at 40 years old with this perfect woman that joined my life maybe 6 months ago. So that's a happy ending in my life of love that otherwise has been extremely sad. James?
Yeah, I remember
Go ahead.
Yeah, I remember for so many years you've had just people that you've talked about that just wanted to destroy your life and gave you so much anxiety. I remember you talking about your anxiety that it would just hurt your heart. And yes. So to see you very happy and calm is really nice. And I'm really happy for you.
All right. Well, thanks for your delivery tonight of this Plato statement. Plato statement on love. What I learned tonight is that Greek philosophers were confused and they were overthinking and they were a bunch of hippies, and ultimately it's their fault if society went the wrong way. Much love to everyone, and James, we'll see you again soon. There will be a Patreon hangout next week. Let us schedule it for the Patreon supporters at the $20 level. Let's schedule it for Tuesday. So Tuesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, join the Patreon or the Subscribestar at the $20 level. We will do this at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 1 hour after the beginning of the regular show. James, good night.
Good night, Jeff. Thank you.